The secret to well-being is discovering the power that is your birthright, the power to create a happier, healthier life, drawn from our own vast internal resources. Join Jules and her guests as they gently guide you to shift your perspective from the familiar negative to the divinely connected, a place that will not only positively impact your world, but possibly shift the planet. It's all right here on Law of Attraction Talk Radio.
Hi, how are you? I'm so glad you could come back to hear another episode of Law of Attraction Talk Radio. Today we're talking to Anthony Mindell, author of this incredibly funny and brilliantly insightful book called At Left Brain, Turn Right. Anthony is the founder of Anthony Mindell Actors Workshop in Los Angeles and New York. And from what I hear, it's the place to be. So what does this have to do with the Law of Attraction? Well, as a matter of fact, it has plenty to do with it. We know that the left hemisphere of our brain analyzes things. That's where our automation occurs. That's our math center. But artists or actors tend to be overly critical of themselves, and they need to get beyond that critical mind into a place where they can create a character or create a masterpiece. And as we know, artists, no matter what medium they're in, they live the majority of their life in the right hemisphere of the brain, where they are passionate about their craft. This is where they must be in order to create. Artists tend to be very spiritual people, in that they know that there is something they must trust to get them where they need to go. And if you really think about it, well, didn't I just describe you as well? When you take a closer look, it really sounds to me like we are all alike and we're all putting the law of attraction into practice. So today it's all about a great book, a great guest, and a great show. Right here on Law of Attraction Talk Radio. We'll be right back after these words.
Need help realizing your dreams? As a hypnotherapist specializing in the law of attraction, Jules Johnson can help you to break through your critical mind into your manifested dream. Get started today by going to lawofattractiontools.com. Set up a personal Skype video or phone session. Law of Attraction Tools is there to help you turn your desires into reality. That's lawofattractiontools.com. You're listening to Law of Attraction Radio Network, enhancing the well-being of millions of listeners worldwide. LOARadionetwork.com is heard through 25 different internet radio stations, as well as iTunes Radio, Stitcher.com, and our mobile apps. The Law of Attraction Radio Network, your trusted source of daily inspiration at LOARadionetwork.com.
Next week is our fun Law of Attraction cruise, and I'm so ready to relax on board, you have no idea, and listen to all of these incredible workshops. We will be doing our Red Jewel Box, so please feel free to join the fun and email me your intentions to be placed in the box. This is something very powerful with being on the Pacific Ocean with the dolphins frolicking all around. To me, it's the most joyful energy of all time. And I would love for you to put your desires into the box to be fully energized with us. So send them to jules@loaradionetwork.com. And by the way, next week we're going to be having Dr. Sereni Pillay, MD, from Harvard Medical School with us. And he's going to be talking about how we can create money. I can promise you this is not a show that you're going to want to miss. After that, on May 6th, we're having another MD, Dr. Ken Stoller. This is going to be an extremely powerful show because Dr. Stoller's son, Galen, was killed in a train accident at the age of 16. And since Galen transitioned, he has written two incredible books about the other side through his father. It is so fascinating what happens after we transition. You're not going to want to miss that one either. You know, we have got some of the most outstanding shows here on Law of Attraction Radio Network, including Marie Diamond, who is the feng shui expert and has really changed my life. You've got to listen to that show. You've got to listen to Captain Dave and, of course, Constance Arnold and the Joy of Wealthy Living show. I mean, in my mind, there's just no reason to get depressed or sad when you have so many uplifting ways to raise your vibration up. So tune in and start creating from that place of well-being. That's why we're here, for you to manifest your desires and to finally realize how truly powerful you are. So now let's get on with tonight's show. I am so delighted to have Anthony Mindell with us tonight. Anthony has such a honest and bright energy that you can just feel in person, and even more so when you're reading his book, At Left Brain Turn Right. I love that title. In Hollywood and New York, he is well known for his prestigious acting schools. But I think he is so much more than a top-rated acting coach. He is truly a powerful spiritual leader that we have all been waiting for. Welcome, Anthony, to the Law of Attraction Talk Radio. I am so excited that you're here.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Thank you for being with us. You know, I love this book, At Left Brain, Turn Right. This is the funnest thing I have read. Funnest, if that's a word.
It is. We've just made it up. Funnest.
Thank you.
More fun.
It is so humorous. Every word. I mean, you just feel good reading it. It's light, but the information in it is so dramatic. So I really want to introduce you to my audience. You have quite a history. You went to India. You are a guru in your own right. But you know, it's kind of like you look at the world in a really fun way. Tell us a little bit about you.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the interesting, what's the quote about, just something that came to my mind based on what you were saying, is the definition of being enlightened is just lightening up. And by no stretch of the imagination am I saying I'm enlightened, but I do find that, like, in the book and the things that I'm teaching, is I always try to approach things from a little bit of a lighter touch, maybe because in a previous life, or maybe in my 20s, I used to be very dramatic and everything, you know, my joke is save it for the stage, because, you know, we're so dramatic. So I do find that a lot of the, my life lessons that I've learned and that I'm, you know, teaching is just, I think we have to have a broader perspective of who we are and where we're standing. And I know it's hard sometimes when we're going through our life trials and our challenges and certain circumstances that are really bringing up our stuff. But I think if you can take a breath and just step outside of yourself, you see that, you know, not only that this too shall pass, but it's actually, I don't think things are nearly as serious as we make them. Even when they're quote unquote bad, because even when things are quote unquote bad, they actually serve a purpose, you know, to get us to the next level of awareness or to change something that needs to be sort of worked out in our life or to get us to a new level of understanding. So everything is essentially good. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think a lot of my experiences in life have come out of that, I think.
And that you had...
I didn't really answer your question, did I?
No, but
I went off.
Okay.
That's how I roll. I will go off on tangents. So you asked me, like, where, like, sorry, ask me.
You went to India. You've got this spiritual side to you that I want you to kind of tell us about.
Yes. I mean, a lot of my life has been about searching and knowing that, you know, we're connected not only to each other, but we're connected to whatever you want to call it, source or divine intelligence or the universe or God or, you know, whatever name you have for it. Like, we are connected in a deeper way. And so I think for me, part of my journey has been doing the work and figuring out what does that mean and what does it look like and how does that show up in my life and how can I be tapped into it more often than the left brain side. And the left brain side is, as we all know, the left hemisphere of your brain is the world of criticisms and judgments and, you know, beating yourself up. And I call it taking the left brain drain train. And so when we're, you know, next stop, Desperation City, you know, like, and when we're in that space, it's very hard to stay connected to something bigger than ourselves. So a lot of my journey has been a journey inwardly, but also geographically. I've been to India 3 times, and I've studied all kinds of meditation and spent time in ashrams, and you know, I bathed in the Ganges. All my Indian friends laugh at me, and they were like, "Oh my gosh, you're more Indian than I am," you know, like, they're like, "I would never do that." But I mean, I think for me, it's also discovering, like kind of what I said earlier, about that the spiritual journey also can be fun. It doesn't have to be heavy-handed and so intense. And so, again, that's a lot of what my teachings and my own learning has been about.
In one of the chapters here, because I have got your book in front of me, and it says that once we present to each moment in our life, we have to acknowledge our feelings. We don't want to feel, so we push out, we act, we do, we show. Talk about that, because that's so true. We don't want to feel.
Yeah. I mean, I think our culture, I think it's interesting, you know, living in the West, living in America, and we're constantly bombarded with things, and everything seems so externally referenced, meaning, you know, it's about status and the cars you drive and the clothes you wear and the people you know and how much money you have and how big your house is and does it have a pool and what's your title and are you a CEO or are you just a VP or, you know, and I think we associate with these things because partly it's culturally what we're taught. Like if we achieve those things or acquire those things, then we are therefore a success, and that we somehow believe that we're going to find meaning and happiness and feeling through that stuff. But we've all discovered that none of that is true. And so I think what's interesting about being in a non-feeling culture, human beings are really desiring at our core level deep connection with people, and we can't find it through technology. You can't find that through things, you know? So the real work is to just become aware of when you're picking up the cell phone or going for that pint of Ben and Jerry's ice cream or turning on the TV or doing things to check out so that you don't have to feel. That's the big work that I'm doing with people.
And in another chapter, you say, and you're talking about working with actors because you're committed to teaching the artist to rely more and more on instinct and really listening to that inner voice.
Yeah, I mean, I think the same thing. I think it's if we're constantly sort of aware of our external world and not aware that there's an inner world calling us, it's very difficult to sort of connect with what that inner world wants to show us. And I do think that we all have hunches or epiphanies or insight or ahas or, again, instinct that wants to tell us and show us the way, but we discount it because for many people, they don't understand what it is because they have no sort of relationship with it. Right. But also, if you're constantly oriented toward, you know, what other people say and what other people are telling you to do, whether it's teachers or parents or gurus or scientists or the media, then you don't really have connection to your own inner compass. So a lot of the work that I'm doing, and I think a lot of the work that the book, you know, is presenting, is finding whatever path of encouragement that is for you to find a bit of an inner practice so you can begin to understand your own inner guidance. You know, a lot of people don't know that they have one.
I know.
You know, which is surprising because we enter and we leave this world by ourselves. You know what I mean? We enter and leave this world alone. So at some level, you know, it's between you and you. It's always going to be between you and you. And so I think I say something in the book about it's great to ask people's advice, people you respect and you admire and people who are helping you on the journey. But I think ultimately the decisions, you know, for your own best evolution and your own best growth come from inside. And it takes, I think, bravery and courage to really listen to that part, even though everybody else may be telling you, oh, don't break up with him, or, oh, you can't do that, you're going to lose your money, or you don't want to leave that job, or, you know, these things that a deeper part of us is saying, but I feel like I want to do that. But then we have the pull of other, you know, externally or represented through people or through, you know, the culture of what we should or shouldn't do, telling us, well, don't do that because then you're not going to be safe, or don't do that because then you're going to be single, or don't do that because then you're going to be alone. Right. And so then you don't listen to the inner guidance. So I find that the inner guidance really never leads you astray. And even if in the short term, I think what's exciting about a life that's more internally referenced is that even if in the short term it doesn't always feel like things are kind of working out the way you're wanting them to work out, it always kind of leads you in the bigger picture to things that could not have come to you had you not said yes to that inner voice, you know? Mm. Like, I mean, my goodness, I mean, this, I'm so excited to be talking to you and the listeners to be hearing this. And I had no idea a few years ago that the things that I was saying yes to would lead me to this moment. Like, but saying yes to those things that don't make sense from the left brain do make sense, a deeper part of us. It makes sense to a deeper part of us. So you got to take the leap of faith.
Right. Very well put. You know, you go into a lot of quantum physics in the book as well. I love this chapter. Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope. I love this.
Well, I mean, you know, do you remember Star Wars? And that was, you know, when Princess Leia with her cinnabun hair roll came out of R2-D2, I think she was presented as a holograph, right? And there's some scientists who believe that we're living in a holographic universe in which all the parts are contained within the whole, and the whole is contained within all the parts. And, I mean, let me just say, preface that by saying I am by no means, like, you know, a scientist. And I even read Einstein for Dummies, and I was too dumb to get it. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I mean, I do find that a lot of the things that I have been teaching from maybe a spiritual or psychological or emotional perspective are now kind of being, there's a lot of research now about, there's a lot of brain science that's coming out there. Brain scientists are saying that we're entering the golden age of brain research because we have all this technology that can, you know, study the brain in a way that we didn't have access to years ago. And so a lot of the things that they're saying about the brain, which isn't necessarily quantum, I should come back to the quantum bit, but, you know, the things that they're saying about the brain are the same things that I may be saying from an emotional, spiritual perspective. And so I find that there's this amazing confluence of spirit and science, which, you know, to me, Einstein, who is a big hero of mine, I mean, he was a spiritualist in many ways, you know, I mean, he talks about the God gap, and I think part of the mystery of it all was, I think, what continued to inspire him to probe deeper. And I find that, to me, you don't have to understand quantum science to understand the applications of some of these things that I'm talking about. And one thing that I think is interesting is, I quote this other quantum physicist in the book, Bill Bryson, who wrote this amazing book called A History of Almost Everything, I think it's called. And he basically is charting sort of the birth of our universe, you know, millions of years ago up until today. And one of the things that he shows is that atomically, it's been proven that scientifically, we share the same atomic structure of 90% or 99% of every other being on the planet. So it's conclusively proven that you and I are one. So I find that really interesting that we are connected in ways that, of course, spiritually we know that, but now there's science to bear that out. And so, yeah, and I mean, I think also in popular culture, like, I think, like, I use that Obi-Wan Ben Kenobi reference because some really great filmmakers and great poets and great writers also are referencing these things that great spiritual teachers have been teaching for millennia, and also science is starting to say, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want people to be concerned about, oh my gosh, this is a science book, because I think I try to approach the quantumness of it all, you know.
But it's very understandable.
Yeah, I think so.
And the way you put it is delightful. And you have exercises in here, a bit of homework. But as I mentioned, my friend picked up the book, and she was in dire straits, and she started doing the homework. It was so wonderful to see the change in her. This book is incredible.
Well, that's the whole purpose of writing it, is that I really, a lot of people call me an advocate for artists, and because the real work that's inspired the book is working with artists and really helping them become empowered and, win back their power and not let an industry or not let the business get them down and shut out their creative selves. But I do find that, the work that I'm doing is applicable to all people. First of all, we're all artists. All of us have an inner artist, whether you're a banker or you're a ballet dancer. It's how do you take that artistry out into the world? And I think part of that is by becoming more reference to the present moment, that you find yourself being more expressed in a more human, vulnerable, creative way, where judgments usually shut us out. Like you could be in line at the Starbucks and you want to tell somebody, I really like your outfit today. It could be a total stranger, or, you really look handsome. But we don't do that because we think, what are they going to think? They're going to think I'm crazy, or I'm a masher, or I'm a stalker, or we have all these judgments. And yet, weirdly enough, people do want to connect, even in ways that we think that they themselves would have judgments about it. They don't. It's like I often say that we in our own minds are more, we beat ourselves up in our own minds more than we would beat up our own worst enemy.
Yes.
Like the things that we say to ourselves are more unkind than we would ever say to somebody that, is our nemesis. And so I find that being in that headspace is it's incompatible with being out in the world in a present way. And so I'm thrilled that people are really starting to respond to the book, and I'm hoping that it does help heal and inspire people.
But going along with what you just said, how do we get over that critical mind?
Well, I mean, I think there are many examples in the book, just really simple, practical, exercises that you can do that. And I think, again, there's new science that's also sort of verifying the same thing. Like there's a book out that talks about, to get in touch with your creative sort of insight or epiphanies, you can go take a nap, or you go and take a walk, and those are things that I actually have mentioned in my book as well. It's like, it's very simple processes where you sort of remove the energy from the left brain and you get into your physical body in a different way. And so the energy of the left brain starts to move into different parts of your body. And then you begin to realize, like, oh, I was so in my head, so sort of stuck in my own world, that I didn't realize, like, I have access to other things that I don't have access to when I continue to hear the things that I'm telling myself in my head. So I think, there are many different, I talk about meditation, I talk about going to take a walk, I talk about, just simply breathing. Just, we forget, breathing from a core part of ourselves drops us in, as opposed to breathing from, our shoulders. Those are just three examples.
What kind of meditation do you recommend? Do you recommend putting the brain on pause, or do you recommend guided imagery? I mean, is there one way in particular that helps us jump over that busy side of the brain?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think there are many different ways. Like I find, here's the thing about meditation. A lot of people say, well, I can't meditate. I can't do that. I can't turn off the mind. And I think the biggest sort of obstacle to overcome is that meditation does not mean the ceasing of thought, because that doesn't really happen, but you can actually find gaps between thought. And so I think people give up because they sit in meditation when they first try it, and their head seem to be, the thoughts seem to be louder and running even quicker than normal. And they're like, oh my God, I can't ever turn my brain off. And so what I encourage people with any kind of meditation practice is that as you, and there are many different kinds. I don't ever tell somebody what specific meditation they should do, but I think you'll find the one that works best for you, whether it's Yes, visualizing or listening to music and kind of going where the music is taking you, or just focusing on your breathing. Like, I give many different examples in the book. Like, you can inhale for an 8 count and then hold the breath for an 8 count and then exhale. And so you're following the breath. Or you could light a candle and look at the candle, or you could repeat a mantra. So there are many different, you know, ways to meditate. But I think the interesting thing is part of the process is, as you continue to do it, like anything, like going to the gym or eating a more healthy diet, the more you start to do it, you'll start, not only will you start to create gaps where you'll have moments where it will feel as if, oh, the thought, something has just happened, which then is the trap, because then you're going to be thinking about the fact that it just happened. But I think the real measure of the changes that occur when you meditate doesn't happen so much in the meditation, it happens out in the world. So if you continue a meditation practice, you'll see out in the world, just on a daily basis, like, whoa, maybe you're not as reactive as you were before. Uh-huh. Maybe when things are challenging to you, you won't get as upset. Maybe you'll not fly off the handle and get freaked out by something. You know what I mean? You'll start to see that you're moving through the world in a less uptight and frenetic and charged place. And that's really what meditation is about. And so not to get caught up so much in, am I doing this right or this isn't working? You just have to stay in the practice. And I think and people will comment on it. They'll say, you know, wow, you seem lighter, or you're having more fun, or you look better, or, you know, wow, you're really sexy today, or, you know what I mean? And so I think that's the thing. It's like any practice. Sometimes I go to the gym and it's like, oh, or I'm doing something and it just doesn't feel like it's working. But if you just stay in the practice, the results do cumulatively add up.
Right, right.
So I think that's the thing, is not to let your belief that you can't do it keep you from doing it.
Especially in the way that we are communicating and reacting to life right now, it's not exactly what you call easy out in the world.
Yeah.
And we could see things twice as difficult as maybe they should be because of all the stress that's going around.
Well, I think it's a stress, but also it's what we were talking about earlier, is technology gets us so plugged into things that we don't realize that stuff is also making us really disconnected and more stressed and more frazzled. Like, we feel like we constantly have to be plugged in and get information and updates and tweets and Facebook alerts and the newest news that's, you know, we're constantly being bombarded. Like, sometimes it's amazing. Like, I read something the other day that made me laugh, because I was reading that now there's new studies that say when we go to sleep, like, let's say I'm going to bed, the first 30 minutes of when we would normally, let's say a year ago, have been actually sleeping, what are we doing now? We're actually on our cell phones reading information on the internet or tweets or whatever.
Right.
And what's ironic about that is, when did I read that? I read that while I was laying in bed, supposed to be asleep. You know what I mean? So I was a case study for them. I just proved that out. But I think I think that kind of stuff is really what's creating distractions, and we don't really realize it. Like, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with being plugged into the social network, but you have to be able to turn it off so that you have moments of repose. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's also studies out about how the younger generations are suffering from, you know, a sort of, I don't want to call it ADD, because I don't like to put any concrete label on anything, because I think that kind of makes it more, I don't know, what's my word, impermeable or a more of an obstruction to healing and growth. But, like, they do show that, again, technology leads to, for younger kids, greater stress and greater, what do you call it, when you're distracted, like attention deficit,
right.
You know, like things like that. So I think we have to find... you've got to find me time,
uh-huh.
You know, and I don't think me time is watching the TV, you know, that's not it. Me time is, yeah, contemplating a good book, the things that you're learning in a book. Me time is listening to music neutrally. Me time is just sitting in silence. Me time is doing yoga and breathing, you know,
mm-hmm.
And I think all those things start to settle the mind.
You have in your book a phrase, and I want you to answer it.
Uh-oh.
Why do so many marriages end in divorce?
Wow. Well, I mean, I'm not married. So I mean, I think I even say that. Maybe I don't. Maybe I should, because I'm no expert on marriage. Although my parents have been married for 55 years. So I do have, you know, amazing, inspiring people who show that it works, you know, for them. But I mean, I'm using marriage as a metaphor for many things, is that I think things often end badly, although again, I think that's too strong of a word, and nothing in of itself is bad or good. It's just, you know, sort of presenting itself as the next chapter of your life. But I think because people, again, get stuck on the way something is supposed to look, and that could be marriage, that could be a relationship, that could be a job, that could be making lots of money, that could be, you know, taking a vacation. It's we have these images that are bombarded to us through the media, that when I get that thing, I will be happy, and it's supposed to look this way. And what's interesting is those images are very, very powerful. They're very powerful. And so they create, I think, a false identity with, okay, now I'm in the marriage, let's say, or now I'm in the job. And I'm realizing my own experience of joy and happiness is not equaling those images or those pictures or those stories that have been perpetuated to me since I was a young kid. And so then you think there's something wrong with you. That's the first part of it. But then I also think you have, what do you call it? You begin to feel a dissonance that then comes out through conflict in some way. It's usually internal conflict that then's expressed externally through a partner, through relationship, you know? And so you begin to realize, like, whoa, this isn't, I thought this thing would make me happy. And maybe the awareness is happiness comes from within first. And then that other thing is sort of attracted to the principle of being happy.
Absolutely.
And so I think that's a big challenge, myself included. I always have to keep coming back to the thing that really brings me joy is being in the process of the moment of something. Once you get to the thing, whether it's, you know, I think we're so focused on the climax that we're not enjoying the sort of foreplay along the way. Ooh. And then, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens after the climax? Well, oh God, okay, now I want to leave you, you know? So I think our culture is so oriented toward, I think there are statistics that say people who end up winning the lottery, the majority of people who end up winning the lottery after how many years they've won the money, they end up having lost all that money and are in a worse state than they were prior to having kind of had this money windfall.
That's true. It's about, right? 2 years.
Okay, see? So again, it's this idea, the attachment to that thing, whether that thing is a boyfriend or a girlfriend or a job or becoming famous or making millions of dollars or having a Ferrari or having four houses or having your own TV show. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with the desiring of the material. I mean, I think that's part of why we're in the world, is to experience ourselves. We're physical beings, you know? I mean, we're spiritual beings having a physical experience, you could say it that way. And so the physical is one way through which we express ourselves and create. But I think we lose sight that once we get the thing, that's going to be sort of the magic pill. And it just isn't. It just is not.
You have in here, think less and create more.
Yes, I love that.
I love that too. Explain that to the listener.
Yeah, I get so passionate about that because I think the thing is we have an idea. You have, and again, I think there's the brain science now that shows where ideas come from. You have an epiphany or you have an insight, you have an aha moment. And the goal is to act on it. But the problem that we have as human beings is that instead of acting on it, you think about it, and then you think about the thought about it, and then you think about the thought 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 about the original idea that you have. And by then it's like a ripple effect. Like you are so far removed from the core of, you know, when you drop a rock into, you know, a body of water, you're so far removed from that original ripple. Your thoughts have expanded out that you generally are connecting to the most external or far removed thought from that original idea. And it's usually contaminated by your own, you know, sort of subjective experiences of, I can't do it, it's a bad idea, people aren't going to like it, it's never going to work. And then you share it with other people. So I could say, I have a really great idea, and I could come to you, Jules, and I know you would be supportive, but like a lot, I could say, you know, I got this thing, and you might say, oh, well, Tony, you know, I don't know. You know what I mean, right? And of course, that could be parents, it could be friends, it could be a lover. And of course, they're trying to be supportive, although some people are not. But we then immediately, what do? We start to doubt that original idea. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think Jerry Lewis says that the doubts that people put in your head are little drops of poison. And it's true, because it corrodes this amazing spiritual connection to, I call it the creative matrix, that we're plugged into. We're just a channel through which ideas and energy and creativity flows. And when I think when you have these ideas, it's your job is to act on them. And what happens is when you act on them, you know, you start to put into play a number of other energies and resources and relationships come to pass that never would have happened had you not said yes to it. But the problem is people often don't, is they back themselves into the corner about overthinking it. And the overthinking of it keeps you from taking action. And, you know, there is the science about it now. There is science that proves that we have these epiphanies that if you follow them out, they lead to great inventions. They lead to, you know, amazing insight. But that doesn't mean that once you start getting it out into the world of doing, that it's still not going to be hard work. It will. I mean, you've got to put energy and elbow grease behind things. It doesn't just la, you know, magically appear. But I think people give up in that whole process. And so I think it gets easier if you just do it. I mean, when that's the Nike commercial, right? Just do it. You know?
That's right.
And I think the other part of that, sorry to interrupt, I think the other part of that makes me excited is that even if it doesn't work out the way the original idea came to you, in the doing of it, it will lead you to something else. I have experienced that in my own life, that it will always lead you to some other sort of creative insight, some other connection, a relationship, some blessing will come out of it. But that requires the doing.
Right.
So you got to listen to those insights, people. You really do.
There is another chapter in here. It says, whip me, beat me, slap me. And I think this is really important for us to understand as well. We are like that.
Oh, yeah, I know. I mean, yes, that could be fun if you enjoy that. But no, I'm using, you know, I'm using that as a metaphor for there's a part of us that's really invested in our own pain and suffering. Mm-hmm. And I just lectured on that this past week. And I think the reason is very simple, is that we have been beating ourselves up about all the things that we aren't for so long that sort of relationship with that part of ourselves is familiar. And so it's known. And so first of all, since it's known, you keep coming back to that, because the science behind that is you have a neural groove in your brain and you just keep rebooting that thing that's familiar to you, right? Mm-hmm. So it becomes a habituated behavior, or it's a habit. And, you know, a belief is just a habit, a thought that you keep repeating over and over again. So you keep going to that because that's all you have access to. But I think the second part of that is also there's a payoff in it. If I continue to tell myself, you know, beat myself up for being a loser, let's say, then I'm always going to stay in that feedback loop of being a loser. And then the events that I experience in my outward life are only going to sort of mirror back that core belief. And so then I can say, oh, you see, that thing didn't work out. I didn't get the girlfriend, or I didn't get the boyfriend, or I lost that job application or that job opportunity. You see, I am therefore still a loser. So you stay in that, I'm drawing a circle with my hand right now. You can't see it, but you are staying in that negative feedback loop. So it becomes a vicious cycle. So the incorrect or flawed belief about yourself keeps you trapped in that paradigm. And at one level, like I said, it does feel good because you've known yourself to be a loser, but that doesn't mean it's true. And so the real work that I'm doing with people is, what would that feel like if you let that go? And at first, it's going to feel very scary because we've a lot of these thoughts do serve a purpose. They have kept us protected, and they are like self-preservation, you know, the mechanics of them help preserve us through life. Like when we were younger and as young adults, like we've needed to use them as a defense mechanism to protect ourselves. But then at some point in our life, we've outgrown them, but then we keep reverting back to them as children, mm-hmm. only because they're there. And so I think the real step is, how do I have outgrown this. I can let this thing go. I can let it go. So I think that's the work. And it's a little scary at first because your option is the other thing that's calling you forward is so unknown. It's nebulous and it's scary to us because it's not identifiable. And so even though it doesn't make any sense to us, that we know at a deep level, I don't want to keep coming back to this way of thinking that makes me feel bad about myself. Mm-hmm. We just do it because of the habit and because it's known. But everything that I'm teaching, you know, Jules, is recognition and recovery. So it's baby steps. So if you recognize that you're doing it, you can recover from it faster and then keep taking a step toward that which you want. And then as you begin to do that more and more, you build a new muscle. And then when you build a new muscle, you're building a new neural groove.
I love that. Recognition and recover.
Recognition and recovery, yeah.
That is so powerful. I love that. Now, it kind of leads in from there to Surrender Dorothy, doesn't it?
You're picking all the great...
I love this book.
I mean, you know, Surrender Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz, which I think is, you know, when you go back and revisit Wizard of Oz, the whole, you know, the metaphor, the symbols of that, I think it's so amazing, so simple, but such an exotic, crazy journey she went on, but she ended up coming right back home. Mm-hmm. And I think home is... inside your heart. Home is, I think it's very spiritual, these some of these movies, that they're basically telling you, you'll discover yourself. You have to go, you know, I think this is I'm going off on tangent now, but this is the Joseph Campbell, you know, mythology and the things that he taught, which is all people need to go out on the adventure. You have to go out of yourself to experience the adventures that help you not only evolve and grow, but also establish your own hero. But you realize that the heroic qualities that are forged out of that journey are all internal. So again, it's all a circle. So you come back to yourself. I mean, Joseph Campbell is a huge influence in my work. I think he's amazing. I'm sure you know him. But the other part of Surrender Dorothy is really just about trying to surrender more in life. And I think that that's so hard because we're control freaks.
Yes.
<He's> like... Oh, it's like, that's the big thing for me, for everybody is I had an acting teacher who once told me, Tony, you can be empowering. You can either be controlling or empowering, but you can't be both at the same time. Mm. And that was really powerful for me because I realized like when I was trying to control things, I was actually shutting off the access to being empowered, to be released, to be in a let go, to be surrendered, to be vulnerable, you know, all these things that really create our own empowerment. And the control part is interesting because we think that we're actually getting what we need by being controlling, but it actually is just the opposite. It's almost like if you think of a water hose,
uh-huh.
and you kink the water hose. So every time, and even right now, like when I'm doing it, my hands are coming together in the form of fists when I'm trying to put that water hose into a kink. Right. And I'm having both sides of the water hose on either side of my hands. And so it's shaped like a little V. It's like it's what's interesting is not only are my hands so clenched together that it's cutting off the flow that wants to move through the hose. And so weirdly enough, it's like that's a metaphor for us is that we're plugged into this creative matrix and we're just this channel. But when we try to control, you're actually, you know, siphoning off your access to that open channel, that energy that's wanting to guide you and open you. You know, the other thing is now that I have my hands closed, I'm looking at them as these fists in front of me. You know, look, if I have something in my hand that I really want to see, it could be, you know, a butterfly, which I would have crushed by now, or, you know, a tiny little flower or a pebble or a grain of sand. In order to experience, what do I have to do? I have to open my hands. I have to open my hands. So I often find that just that imagery is really powerful. Look at how often during the day we are closed fists. We meet the world with closed fists. And that's incompatible with being in a let go.
Yeah.
You know? And so I think the work is, and it's, you can just try it if the listeners are listening right now, just open your hands up and sort of open them up to, you know, the sky a little bit, and you feel this sort of, you know,
yeah.
It feels so much better than, are you doing that right now?
Yeah.
Yep. That is surrender, you know, and I think that is our natural state. That is our natural state.
It but does feel good.
It does feel good, right? To just be open. That is who we are. So I get it. We've been hurt and abandoned and cheated and told we weren't good enough and punished and disciplined, and lots of things have happened on our way that make us start to slowly close down and close those fists. But we just have to keep coming back to breathing and opening, breathing and opening. Those things, those circumstances, those challenges, those definitions are not who you are. They aren't who you are.
Wow.
I'm totally going to start crying now. I cry a lot, but that's, you know.
I love that.
Really powerful, you know. It's really exciting. I think when people are in that open space, you are connected to, wow, that's how powerful I can be.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more fun. Isn't it more fun to just have your hands open, just be open?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That is very powerful. That is very powerful. And if we could keep on practicing that and not forget it, but then we go through our daily lives with the technology and everything, then they start shrinking back out of the clothes.
Yeah. Well, I think part of it is, you know, I don't have that exercise in the book. That just came to me just now, but I think that's, something that simple. You could be driving and feel your body completely stressed and your hands are like clenched together. You could be at a meeting or just somewhere at the Starbucks. Just opening your hands and just taking a few minutes to breathe into that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Real simple.
It is. That is simple. Tell me, what do you think, being an acting coach,
mm-hmm.
Tell me, what do you think the most inspiring movies that we can keep on watching to keep us centered?
Well, I mean, I think I mentioned, you know, a few of them in the book that I think have deeper spiritual messages, you know, from anything from Groundhog Day, which is funny,
yeah.
You know, but or Avatar, which I think James Cameron is an amazing spiritualist in a way, because his, you know, a lot of that movie is really kind of based on Native American folklore and Native American culture. And also it's the hero's journey. It's also very Joseph Campbell. I think nowadays too, Jules, there's so many documentary filmmakers that are making, you know, movies about the spirit and about the environment and social causes that I think, you know, inspire and uplift. And I think that that's the direction that filmmaking and creating is going, is that I think at one level the audiences are going to be wanting more, they're wanting more material that fulfills them at a deeper level.
Right.
You know?
Right. I interviewed Martin Sheen
The
Way.
Yeah.
And I thought that was an excellent movie of inner spirit, of finding out and having that quiet to figure out your pain.
Yeah.
Beautiful movie. And then there's other movies such as Forrest Gump.
Oh, yes. That's a great movie.
Isn't it?
Yeah, great movie.
Do you think the movies are headed in that direction, though, where it's more spiritual? Because it seems to me like on the TV, all you're really getting are those reality shows.
I know. It's interesting, isn't it? Like, I mean, I like to be hopeful that I think we're entering a new age of like these conversations that you and I are having, and you and other guests, and you know, the work that Oprah Winfrey is doing, I think, mm-hmm. is so amazing. And you know, I think that I find that for myself out in the world, the conversations that I'm having with people are more oriented to this kind of speaking. And you know, 10 years ago when I first started teaching, nobody was really, I mean, of course, people have always been talking about this kind of stuff, but it wasn't so in the popular vanguard. You know what I mean? It wasn't so culturally conscious. And now everywhere I turn, at some level, somebody's talking about it, what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that there's a shift. And I think that Who knows? I mean, I think that ultimately big corporations, there again, big corporations now, a lot of them bring in meditation teachers, or I know that there's a lot of, you know, big Fortune 500 companies that bring in Vedic meditation teachers or yoga, or, you know, are looking at alternative ways to bring creativity to the workplace. Mm. And so I think artists too are always on the leading edge of showing the rest of the world what's possible for us, mm-hmm. you know, because art is really mirroring back to humanity, our potential and what's possible for us at the heart level and the soul level. So, you know, I think the artists keep us connected and keep us alive to that. So I do think there's always going to be a place for it.
Artists are really terrific creators. What they think they do manifest because they put passion behind it.
Yeah, that's totally true.
It's totally true. But they can also create the very worst for them as well.
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting because that word passion, you know, comes from the Latin, the suffering. And I think it's passio, which I think comes from the word Latin suffering, as in the suffering of the Christ. And I think what's interesting about that is when you can transmute and transform suffering into, and actually I find that really great artists use those challenges or those periods that really create suffering into really great quantum creativity. And so wherever you are in your life, wherever juncture you are, I think it's about understanding and blessing that this is also a part of your creative experience. Now, you know what I mean? Like, this part is also helping you get to the next place that you'd really like to be. So you can't beat yourself up for being in it. I think it's always about being gentler with ourselves when we are in a place that creates suffering or struggle. Mm-hmm. But I also find that, yes, suffering can be a really amazing tool when you learn how to channel it in a way beyond the ego part. And I think that's the challenge, is that we get stuck in the paradigm of the victim or woe is me or, you know, why does this happen to me? And you get stuck in a paradigm and then you can't get out of the suffering. But I think when you begin to use the suffering and transform it into helping the higher good, then it becomes a very tangible, powerful force. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think any great teachers haven't had, you know, please, a lot of them have been murdered for it. You know what I mean? They've gone through a lot of suffering. But like, you know, Martin Luther King and Gandhi and like really great teachers have been, you know, eradicated from our earth. But I think it goes to show the kind of suffering that they had to overcome in order to teach a greater message.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But I think that's what creates the message in the first place, is what I'm trying to say. That without that suffering, they wouldn't have been the people that they had become.
Yeah, Nelson Mandela.
Nelson Mandela, who's still, did he just die? No, he's still alive.
Yeah, he's still alive.
But I mean, yeah, look at, he was put in jail for 30 years. Yeah. You know what I mean? So yeah, but I mean, I think that suffering is what is creating the platform for that kind of teaching.
Right. Brilliant. Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. Now tell everybody how they can get your book. And they've got to read this book. Everybody will enjoy every word of it. It's just fun.
Well, thank you. Yes. I mean, you can get it. You can get it at Amazon. You can go to our website, which is www.leftbrainturnright.com. At leftbrainturnright.com. There are specialty bookstores you can get it. I it's not in all Barnes and Nobles yet, but like we're sort of rolling that out. It is in some in the LA area. You know, I think Amazon is the best way right now if you just do it virtually. I'm not quite sure, all your listeners are from all over the place. So or you, like I said, you can go to our website at leftbrainturnright.com and it will guide you. And yeah, I'm really excited. I hope your listeners get it and that it inspires them and they pass it on to other people. And I was telling Jules before the show started, I really want to, like, whoever forms the first book club, I will travel to wherever you are and like lead a workshop. I really want to do like a book club. I think it would be so much fun. It would. And then we'll have margaritas, you know, or something.
Well, That's wonderful. You are really down to earth, and I just love talking to you.
Thank you. You
are a spiritual guru, but you're so much more than that. And so thank you so much for taking the time and coming on and allowing me to introduce you to my listeners.
Well, Jules, I'm very grateful for you and for bringing me on here and the work that you're doing, which is finding different voices. Really, it's all the same message, isn't it? But finding different voices that, you know, are kind of sharing what's possible for each of us. So thank you for having me. I had a really great time.
Oh, thank you. And to all my wonderful listeners, I'll talk to you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another great show from Law of Attraction Talk Radio. If you'd like to comment on tonight's show, send an email to Jules@LOARadionetwork.com and have a great week.